Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroth here. Again, once again, welcome to our teleseminar. We're a little early this time around. Usually we do them every 2 weeks, but we did one last week, and we're doing one again this week, because next week, Sunday, we're going to be on site, on course, running a course, our definitive prep course in Los Angeles. So won't be able to do it then, so we're doing it a week early. So... hence the meeting today and us being out of sequence. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, as always, just the way this works, we've had two people that have sent us some cases that they're concerned about, and we'll talk about how to present, how to defend them. And outside of my receiving the email, which briefly describes the cases, one from each of them, this is unscripted, and we'll see where this goes. So that's the story. Let's just see if we have our access participants with us. Matilda, are you there? Matilda?
Yep, I'm here.
Wonderful. Welcome, and thank you so much. And secondly, Alex. Alex, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, Alex, and thank you to you too as well. Welcome. Let's get right on with it. Matilda, let's start with you. Go ahead and, I mean, I've got your email in front of me, but go ahead and just briefly tell everyone listening in about your case and what is your concern.
Yeah, so brief description of the case. So this is a 52-year-old female with a history of pelvic pain and dysmenorrhea and three previous C-sections, who had previously had an endometrial ablation, who then came to me for these continued reasons and declined any further medical management. And so she then underwent a total laparoscopic hysterectomy, bilateral self-injectomy with some lysis of adhesions. During the case, other than the lysis of adhesions, it was pretty uncomplicated. However, 12 hours postoperatively, she then developed some hemodynamic instability and an acute abdomen, and then was taken back to the OR for diagnostic laparoscopy, exploratory laparotomy, and then was found to have some blood in the abdomen, removed the blood, and then we placed some hemostatic sutures on the vaginal cuff. And yeah, that was the general of the case. I guess my question is, I'm just more concerned about the questions they're going to ask me and how I can defend this case, I guess. I don't know. Exactly.
Okay, and that's exactly what I thought you were going to ask me. And I will just tell you, folks, that most of you have been signing into these teleseminars for a long time now. You know, you've heard this before. This is a case with from the exam point of view, a most delightful, delicious complication. And it's...
I figured you were
going to
say that.
yeah, it's beautiful. And the reason I say it is because you can work out so easily what they're going to ask you, and it's so easy to prepare, and it's so easy to impress the examiner. So this case is going to be worth about 3, maybe 4 minutes worth of conversation in your exam, and we can expect you to just, you know, run away with it during those 3, 4 minutes. So that's why I say this is a great question. So, in a great case. So let me just go through a few things, because this is a specific case, but the general principles involved are relevant for everyone. So let me just start with a small thing. Let me ask you, Matilda, did you do the endometrial ablation, or was it done by someone else?
No, I did not. That was done by another provider.
Okay, so the point that I'm driving at, and folks, all of you need to do this with all of your cases, because there was one, to my mind at least, one thing that didn't jive in your presentation, and that is you had a patient who presented with pelvic pain and dysmenorrhea. Is an endometrial ablation a treatment for pelvic pain and dysmenorrhea?
No, it isn't. It's usually AUB.
Correct. So, you know, you didn't do the ablation, and so it makes it easier for you to defend that issue. But the point that
right,
I'm
I think she
Unisol,
had a history of AUB in the past. Yeah, I think that's what it was. But
yes,
then her presenting concern to me was the pain.
But just look what happened now. If and this is the point I want to make to you and everyone listening in. If I were, let's say I was tired, I've been examining all day for the last 3 days, and if I had not come back to you to ask you about this issue, I would have been left with the notion maybe this candidate is doing a certain procedure for the wrong indication, and you don't want the examiner to think that. So all of you need to look at your cases and look at the presentation and make sure, does everything that you say fit? Does it gel together? Does it all jive together correctly? And does it all make sense? And Matilda, I think you can see now.
That makes sense. Yep.
So, you know, you've got to say, the way to present this, if you've got this kind of issue, folks, for Matilda, in this case, it's very easy. You can say, you know, she had pelvic pain and dysmenorrhea. Those were her major findings, but she did have an endometrial ablation by a colleague, and I have to assume there was an element of abnormal uterine bleeding as well. So you just show that you're, you know, even if the other person...
Thinking about the reasons, yes, of course.
Yeah, that, so, you know, she had an AUB. I have to assume she had, she had an endometrial ablation. I have to assume there was some AUB in her history as well. Okay, just acknowledge it. Otherwise, it looks like you're totally comfortable with a patient presenting with dysmenorrhea and chronic pelvic pain having an endometrial ablation. And that you wouldn't want to defend that
position,
you understand? So just be aware of that. Okay. So that's the one minor thing. The whole big thing here is this complication, okay? The conversation here is going to revolve around the differential diagnosis and workup of one, unusual excessive postoperative pain. Number two, dizziness or syncope, and there I'm talking about symptomatic anemia, okay? Three, I mean, she presented post-op day, I think in the first 24 hours, you said. She may not have yet developed a fever,
yeah,
but she probably would have.
Yeah.
Okay, so it could present as post-op fever as your differential diagnosis and workup of post-op fever, okay? And folks,
okay,
when it comes to these kind of post-op complications, any of you who have any post-op complication, they love it. And I would encourage every one of you to know this very, very well. Whatever it is in your particular case, that case becomes a very important case for you. Now, the next thing is you had bleeding from the cuff. Am I correct? Is that where it was?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like, and that's because I'm telling you right now, but there was, like, close to almost 2 liters in the abdomen. We just did not, actually, I don't think it was from the cuff, but that's the only area that, like, was kind of raw. We didn't actually find an actual beard, we took some hemostatic sutures there. So,
yeah, let me share something
I can't really
with
tell
you.
You.
No, okay, but in this exam, you just said to me, you know, I'm telling you this, that there's 2 liters of... I would encourage all of you in a similar situation to, you've heard me say this 1,000 times this year, be open and honest. I would present this case and say, you know, this case was a little frightening because when I went in post-op with the laparoscopy, I realized I had to open immediately. There was a hemoperitoneum of approximately 2 liters. Once I cleared it out and had a chance to inspect, I've got to be honest, I was not able to identify a localized bleeding vessel. I saw some oozing on the cuff. I took care of that. In retrospect, I think there might have been a very strong ooze or a small blood vessel that had been bleeding, but it had clotted off and it was stable now. And I watched it for several minutes after irrigating, and she was absolutely dry. So what was the definite specific cause of the hemiperitoneum? I don't know. But I think it was a small bleeder or a generalized ooze. How does that sound as I present it to you, Matilda?
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And I feel like that's kind of, you know, my question was kind of a how much do I say and how do I actually fully present it to, you know, I mean, I do think I managed this the right way. I do think I was very closely watching the patient and I took her back within 12 hours. So I feel like that was pretty good. I just wasn't sure how much I should really say in the moment about, you know, how much blood I saw and, you know, all those things.
But
so I think that sounds very good.
Be honest. And also, and folks, this is a general principle again for every one of you listening in. Be honest and share what really is so important in a case like this. Share with your examiner what your thought processes were. Okay? So I went in, the first place I was thinking maybe there would be a pedicle, that a ligature that had slipped, but everything was intact.
Right,
I then looked at the vault. I then looked at other areas. As I was repairing the vault, I was concerned, you know, what are the local structures? I had to be aware of the ureter and the bladder base being there. You know, think aloud because this enables you to shine in the examiner's eye.
Great.
So does that make sense to you?
No, that totally makes sense. Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Are you comfortable with this case now in terms of presenting it and the issues?
Yes, I think so. I think that makes a lot of sense how you find out.
Okay. Good. I just want to add one more thing. Anyone who's got a ureter injury, obviously, but if you've got a cuff problem, be it bleeding or dehiscence, anything where you've got to go back and over-sew, anything related to the cuff, and any pelvic, you know, severe pelvic hemorrhage, where you get into the pelvis and you just see a lot of blood, the one thing that's imperative to mention in the exam is that you irrigate fully and you don't place any stitch in the pelvis unless it's under direct visualization. You can't put it down
Absolutely.
Into a pool of blood and hope you get it. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but they will give you a traumatic or ligated ureter or something like that if you do that. So you always emphasize that I make sure I can see exactly where every stitch is going. And then lastly, or actually there are two more things. You've got to be able to describe where are the common locations, sorry, that's not the best English. Where are the locations on the ureter that we find we most commonly injure the ureter, okay? So, for example, it's in the infundibular pelvic. It's when you're closing up the bladder and the two other spots, when you're going for the cervical ligaments. So just be able to describe that. And again, this is a conversation on ureteric injury and bladder injury waiting to happen. So you've got to be able to discuss in both instances how would you close such an injury, what layers would you close in, what suture material would you use for each layer, and what stitch type would it be? Would it be a continuous simple, continuous locking, interrupted, etc.? Okay, so that's where you're going to go with this. And it's a great case, and you should be totally comfortable and almost drooling at the thought that they're going to ask you about this because it's going to be so good for you.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
Excellent, Matilda.
Thank
Very
you.
Nice case. Well done.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Alex, you're up? You're there? Alex, hello?
Yeah, here.
I think we lost. Oh, you're there. Okay, Alex. All right, welcome once again. Again, I've got your email, so I can read the case in front of me. But go ahead and present it so everyone understands what's going on.
Okay, so I had a 20-year-old G1P0 at 25 weeks, one day, who presented in preterm labor in advanced dilation. She had prenatal care elsewhere, which she was new to me and new to our practice. At presentation, initially she declined all interventions due to her phobia of needles, so she didn't get an IV, she didn't get any steroids or any magnesium. Meanwhile, while we were trying to, I work at a small rural hospital, so we're trying to coordinate with a NICU flight to be available for the delivery. At that time, trauma, and then I found her to have an umbilical cord prolapse. So, you know, after careful discussion and counseling, she agreed to an IV and to an emergency cesarean section. The C-section was complicated by postpartum hemorrhage. Abgars were 3, 6, and 7 at 1, 5, and 10 minutes, respectively. NICU flight, luckily, was there to take care of the baby. The baby was flown to the University Hospital and had an extended NICU stay and unfortunately passed on postpartum day number 73. So, kind of the case in a nutshell there.
Okay, by the way, that was a very good presentation. And Matilda, you also did a very good presentation. Folks, for all of you listening in, I think you'll agree, in both presentations, we got a very decent understanding of what's going on in the case. And it was all presented succinctly. I had one criticism for Matilda, which I mentioned. But other than that, I think in both instances, it was very succinct and very nicely presented. Okay, Alex, I got a question for you. Looking at this case from 40,000 feet, what do you think is the one area of questioning that perhaps is most important in this case? Where is your most likely to go?
You know, I can't really tell, but I somehow see kind of like the C-section under local questioning going on. I don't think that's the most common.
Yeah, you got to know that. There's no question. That is something else that I'm getting.
But I can see them asking me that.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get the answer to my question. And people listening in, I think, are more likely to agree with me when they hear it than are you, because you're in the thick of it. But this is a case on medical ethics and counseling. Medical ethics, because the issue of patient autonomy comes in, okay?
Yes.
And you've got the classical case of a maternal-fetal conflict. The mother is not advocating in the best interest of her baby. She's willing to... I mean, it's a tragic situation, but she effectively, I'm being very harsh now and I'm being judgmental, but I'm just calling a spade as I see it. But she effectively allowed her baby to die when it wasn't necessary out of her personal fear of needles. Look, you managed the case. I might be a little harsh, but am I on the right track when I say that, or am I missing something, Alex?
No, you're 100% correct.
Okay. So you've got a maternal-fetal conflict. And now that becomes a huge ethical dilemma. You know, you've got an ethical responsibility to the patient. You also have an ethical responsibility to the baby. I'm going to up the ante with you for the sake of the argument. And this kind of thing can happen in exam. Now, I understand... Probably maybe 10% of you listening in have a case similar to what we're describing. And for the rest, it's not that relevant, but you still need to understand the concept of what can happen here. What would you say, Alex, if the examiner turned around to you in this particular case and said, okay, I understand the situation, you put the baby on the monitor, and you see the baby is developing a terminal bradycardia, and the mother still refuses needles or IVs, what are you going to do?
I mean, ultimately, you can only do what the patient wants you to do, is what the way I see it. You have to respect the patient's autonomy. As long
that's
as she's
exactly
been counseled,
correct.
She knows the risk.
Yes, that 100% correct. As long as she's been counseled appropriately, and that's why I say this is an ethical question and a counseling question. So as long as you've counseled her correctly, the examiner's going to put you to the wall, your back to the wall, and say, listen, you can see the baby is dying in front of your eyes. It's the easiest thing to go ahead and deliver her, but the mother says no. Are you going to stand by and watch this baby die when you've got the ability to save the baby? And your answer has to be exactly what you heard Alex said. I would say it a little slightly differently. I would say, you know, this is a very frightening situation, and the stakes are high. But as much as I would want to be able to help the baby, primarily my relationship is with the mother, and I have to respect her wishes. And as such, I will do my utmost to try and get her to agree. But if she doesn't agree to a C-section, I have no choice but to respect her wishes. And if the baby dies, that's her choice. You say it very openly, okay? So are you comfortable with handling that kind of situation?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you another question. And this is also for any of you who are listening in who've got patients who are witnesses who refuse a blood transfusion. This is another example in the PPH scenario. If this patient did not receive her prenatal care at a different institution, would the management have been any different for you?
No.
I think I can give a better answer. And maybe I phrased the question unfairly. I would say the point that I'm trying to get at is, as I understand it, and correct me, I may be wrong, you were thrust into an acute, immediate, high-stakes emergency situation. You hadn't seen the patient before. You had no prior contact with her. Am I correct on that score or not?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about the patient. The patient.
So the point that I'm getting at is, had you have seen her previously in the prenatal clinic, you probably would have picked up this issue before. And the counseling would have been able to occur in far more conducive and relaxed circumstances, and you would have had time for a second opinion and referrals to make sure she understood the implications of her decision. Given the fact that this was presented to you in an acute situation, you were denied that luxury, and that was just unfortunate, but that was a function of circumstance. Would you be comfortable to say that in the exam?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and for those who have cases similar to this, that's a good thing to keep in mind. Had I seen this patient earlier in the office, I would have been able to counsel her a little bit more extensively and under far more opportune conditions. But this was denied me, so I had no choice. Okay? So that's the primary issue. Secondary issues, absolutely. How do you perform a C-section under local? And there's a particular question which, look, the issue of C-section under local, any of you listening in can get this question because it can come to you as a structured case of the day. It's an emergency situation. Those of you who have already come to our definitive prep course, courses that we've already held, will have heard that you've got to be able to respond to any emergency that they throw at you. So a prolapse cord is something that any of you can be visited with in the exam. My question to you is a very strange question, but it's very relevant for you, Alex. What measures can you use to keep this baby's blood flow, this fetus's blood flow going while and adequate, while to give yourself as much time as possible to counsel her? Another scenario they may give you is if you call for a stat C-section and the OR is only going to be ready in 15 minutes. So what do you do during this? What can you do to optimize things for this fetus in the interim? Any idea where I'm going with this, Alex?
Yeah. Is this after the cord prolapse and diagnosed?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So, you know, if the patient has been checked, you know, I would recommend that the presenting part be elevated to relieve pressure on the cord. You can put her
No, I think I misheard you. Do you put, the head is elevated to relieve pressure on the cord, or is the head elevated with pressure on the cord? I didn't hear you. What did you say?
Well, for instance, if we diagnose umbilical cord prolapse,
yes,
I would recommend that as soon as it's diagnosed, you know, whoever diagnoses it obviously shouts it out so everybody's aware, and then
yes,
continue to kind of press on the presenting part so that it's not...
Okay, I thought you were pushing on the cord, and that's why I jumped out of my skin. Okay, fine. You spoke exactly correctly, then I just didn't hear you, sorry. Okay, that's one thing. What else?
I would do that. You know, put her in Trendelenburg position. Something else that you could do is put her in the knee to chest position as well to kind of help relieve.
Yeah, the knee chest might be a little bit better than the Trendelenburg because you're not having any pressure on the major vessels. Okay, and there's one more thing that I can think of. Can you any idea?
That's all I can think of right now.
Okay, you put a Foley catheter into the bladder and blow up the balloon and then fill the bladder. What that does is the bladder helps push the head off the pelvis and the pelvic brim, thereby taking away the squeezing potential of the cord. Okay, so you've got that. What else? With cord prolapse, if it's sticking out, just cover it with a warm, wet cloth or lap sponge or anything, and don't manipulate the cord. That's also important. Okay. What else is important here? You knew you had a cord prolapse. If you would have diagnosed this not at a state of advanced prolapse, but let's say she was 3 centimeters dilated, could you have considered transferring her?
With a cord prolapse?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. I would obviously...
You're correct. You're correct. My only criticism was you took too much time thinking about that. And folks, this is a point that I want to make for all of you. Don't be seen to be part of a situation where you authorize either transferring or receiving a patient which is unstable. And any patient with a cord prolapse is pretty much by definition unstable. So that would be a major faux pas. You answered correctly, and you obviously I threw you with the question a little bit, but you've got to just be comfortable to say no, this is, and give the reason why not. This is an unstable situation and an emergency. I don't think she's safe. The baby's not safe to be transferred, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the baby didn't make it. You've also got a fetus that's going to be delivered at 25 weeks of gestation. I think I may have mentioned this in one of our recent sessions. The lots of us in this situation, how do you counsel patients where this pregnancy is on the cusp of viability? And it becomes a big discussion on the prognosis for the fetus. And so what you all of you, especially you, Alex, you need to know what kind of a prognosis does your NICU or your nursery offer for a baby at 24 weeks or 28 or 32 or 35 weeks, whatever the case may be. Because you can't counsel a patient for preterm labor and delivery if you don't know what your nursery can offer you in terms of statistics for survival. So I want to encourage each and every one of you, if you aren't able to answer that question, just get on the phone with your nursery and ask them. It's one phone call. You'll get the answer, and you can then respond with confidence. So be able to give the strict, the neonatal complications of severe prematurity, Also, don't forget in these early stages, if you're going to be talking about doing a C-section, you've got to add into the mix the fact that this is probably going to be a classical C-section with further implications for mom. And obviously, we mentioned you'd be able to discuss how you do a C-section under local anesthetic. But I have to come back to the primary thing. This is a conversation on counseling, and be comfortable to say in the exam the extent to which you felt compromised in being presented with this acute emergency in such an unusual situation of a patient refusing. And this goes to you only, Alex. I want you to use the term. This was a classical materno-fetal conflict of interest where the mother was not advocating in the best interests of her baby. And it's a huge, and that's why you bring in the ethics, and you've got to be able to give the four pillars of medical ethics, and which is the one that's being questioned here, and it's the pillar of autonomy, patient autonomy, okay? So, Alex, are you okay with that?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions you got on this particular case?
I think we hit them all and some, so thanks.
Okay, excellent. All right, good. So I just we're almost done. I just want to, for people listening in, I want to encourage all of you to participate. You notice I didn't mention last name, so even if you get an answer wrong, no one will know who you are, so you don't have to feel worried about being embarrassed in front of, you know, all your colleagues. Let me ask you, Alex, be honest. Do you feel this was a helpful experience being on the hot seat and discussing and defending your decisions? Be honest. Do you think it was worthwhile, that it was good?
It was very helpful, yeah. I wasn't zeroing in on the actual biggest issue at hand, which was the question of autonomy and the ethics of the case. So I really appreciate you highlighting that.
Good, good, good. Matilda, are you still there with us? Hello?
Yes, I'm still here.
And can I ask your opinion? Again, please be honest. If you think it was a waste of time, I've got broad shoulders, I can, a thick skin, I can take it. Your sense of being on the hot seat and volunteering to do this today?
No, I think it's great, number one, because it helps you kind of think of your case yourself and not exactly have to present it. But I also found it helpful that you pointed out the endometrial ablation, which I did think about previously, but then I kind of brushed it off. But I should bring it up that the same way that you explained it, so it was very, very helpful. And the fact that, like, I know that I can defend how I went about my case and just to be confident about what I did to be honest about what I saw. So I think it was very helpful.
Excellent. So folks, all you listening, you heard that from our two volunteers. I really want to encourage you because the preparation for this exam, to all intents and purposes, you folks have had, in essence, no experience in this medium of examination. And you've got to get used to it. It's nothing like a written exam. It's a different skill set that you need. And a major skill is being able to talk about your cases and discuss them and defend your decisions in the management of each case. So you need to get as much exposure to the oral exam environment as you can. This is one such opportunity, and it's free. So I encourage you to volunteer. I also will share with you that as we get closer and closer to the exam, What typically happens is more and more people are volunteering because you folks are feeling the pressure, and oftentimes it happens we get more people asking to be on the hot seat than we can handle. So now we're still a few months away from the exam. There's not so much pressure, so this is a great time to volunteer, and I encourage you to do so whenever we have our next seminar and beyond. So let me finish then by saying most of you have already signed up for our Definitive Board Prep course. I'm really preaching to the choir here, but we are going to be having a Definitive Board Prep course in Los Angeles starting today, next week, in 1 week. If you're in the West Coast region, you might want to consider that. It runs Sunday through Wednesday. There are also an additional 2 days which you can view online. So it's a six-day course, but only four of them are live in person. And then roughly the second week of September, we're going to be doing the same thing in Baltimore. That'll be our last live in-person to finish board prep course for the year. So if you're interested and you haven't yet not yet signed up, this would be your last two options. That being said, our next teleseminar will be on September the 8th, and I think that's 3 weeks away because we made a catch-up session today because next week we will not be around to do this teleseminar. But the next teleseminar that we have will be the 8th of September, and love to see you all there and join us and invite your friends to come and join us and volunteer to be on the hot seat. So to our live attendees, Matilda and Alex, thank you so much for joining us. I'm pleased you found it so helpful. To the rest of you listening in, thank you for joining us. This obviously, as always, will be available on the archives. And if you have any questions regarding anything on this exam, please get in touch with the office. We'll be more than happy to help you out wherever we can. So thank you, Matilda. Thank you, Alex. Thanks to all listening in. And this then concludes our teleseminar. Thank you so much, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.